Hello and welcome to another episode of the Rethink Energy podcast, where the Rethink Energy team talk about the technology behind this week's energy news. I'm your host for today, our automotive and battery analyst, Connor Watts, and I'm joined yet again by our hydrogen analyst and editor, Bogdan Avramuta.
Hello, Connor.
As well as our solar analyst, Andrew Swantonar from Australia.
Good morning.
In this week's episode, we're going to be talking about a new report released this week, looking into the future trends within the battery raw material space and what's going to be important within the next couple of years and then longer into the future. Then we're going to be talking about the price validity of turquoise hydrogen, of which we've recently done a quick price assessment of. And finally, we're going to be looking into a new type of grid congestion coming from China's coastal provinces as they distribute a monstrous amount of distributed photovoltaics. Finally, we're going to take a look at a couple of the short items from this week's issue. To get straight into it, we're not going to go into too much detail as to this report, as the executive summary is widely available on the internet. You can find that on our website or on social media. Our primary findings from this report is that this lithium price lull is going to be kept down by the on and off taking of lepidolite resources in China for the next year and a half or so, because increases in efficiency when it comes to the consumption of these raw materials from China and increasingly from European and Western battery manufacturers, but from increasing energy densities, will help keep lithium usage down relative to the increase in demand that is set to take hold in the next year or two. This complicates from then onwards, so from about 2026 onwards, because that side of innovation is going to be leaning towards lithium metal anode usages. That increases the lithium usage per kilowatt hour battery relative to a graphite anode, which increasingly uses silicon. Increasing silicon utilization within a lithium battery decreases the amount of lithium per kilowatt hour because it increases the energy density quite uniformly and quite simply, in that you just reduce the proportion of lithium usage per kilowatt hour based on the increase in energy density. When it comes to modeling adoption of lithium metal anode usage, it depends on the increase in energy density, but you can be increasing the amount of lithium used per kilowatt hour battery. That's why it complicates from there onwards, in that you have a split between companies pursuing the silicon anode side of it and other companies increasingly reaching scale and at the very least high hundreds of megawatt hour production of lithium metal anodes and going rapidly into the gigawatt hour scale at the end of the decade. The other side of this is that it looked specifically at the policies affecting subsidies. Our primary concerns as of right now lay in, firstly, the politics, which is neither here nor there, of maintaining the Inflation Reduction Act, but that happens as it happens, and we'll take that as it comes, because there's nothing more unpredictable than American politics. That the IRA, from a value perspective, as of right now, it prioritizes nickel as opposed to lithium when it comes to sourcing requirements. The level of expansion being seen in international nickel supply is almost purely in Indonesian nickel laterite ores, which are Chinese owned. And we did a bit of a piece on this week, looking at it from the lens of a British company operating in Brazil called Brazilian Nickel. And they're looking at producing nickel laterites using a much less environmentally damaging process called heap leaching, as opposed to the Indonesians and the Chinese using high pressure acid leaching, which produce a particularly awful mine tailings and has a horrible carbon footprint associated with it. The benefit of this is that should this mine go into production at a reasonable scale so as to keep costs down, it will be eligible for IRA subsidy, and it will be among the few projects that are coming online as a source of supply. The problem with the supply going and increasing from Indonesia and China in particular is that none of this is going to be eligible for IRA subsidy, and it being such a low cost means it can keep the price down of other projects that would otherwise be coming online. Just this last 2 weeks, two projects producing nickel have been cancelled, or at least put on hold until the pricing environment recovers, because the project economics simply didn't work when competing with these nickel laterite ore projects from Indonesia. It also very briefly looked at the waning relevance of cobalt and how it's not going to be a particularly important factor going forwards, primarily due to the fact that the cutting-edge high nickel ternary battery cathode ratio is going to be changing from 8:1:1 of nickel cobalt manganese to 9:0.5:0.5 nickel cobalt manganese. And so it's halving the cobalt consumption within a cathode material, which leads to a roughly half reduction in the battery itself. And a company in Brazil, again called CBMM, is quoting that companies are increasingly looking to replace cobalt with niobium, which will further dent cobalt demand, because rather than needing 5% cobalt within the cathode material, with niobium you only need something between 0.2 and 0.5% niobium to have the same effect as 5% of cobalt, or 10% of cobalt, which means you can load more nickel onto it, increasing energy density even further. So it's not just an economic advantage in removing cobalt, it's not just a social advantage with regards to removing cobalt, it's also economic. You're increasing the energy density, and it's a product side improvement.
So what's the prognosis across lithium and nickel and perhaps anything else that might end up as a shortage? Will there be a shortage? Will there be a shortage just for the US?
That's complicated. So with regards to there being shortages for certain regions, broad consensus is that there is going to be parallel markets within the high-value materials, such as lithium and such as nickel. That's one thing that, within the nickel supply chain in particular, can keep mines online, in that if you have IRA-eligible nickel being produced from the US or Brazil or anywhere outside of Indonesia or China, effectively, Australia and such, then you will likely be paid a premium for companies that trying to fit IRA subsidies. This can keep you in the green, as opposed to just being forced to shutter as Indonesian expansion continues, which will lead to an interesting situation of the broad nickel market being in surplus while the US or Europe may be in shortage. And so the overall market will be in a significant surplus because of Indonesian nickel laterites, but that will purely be going to China. And so China will be in surplus while the US will be in minor deficit. When it comes to lithium, the next year and a half, 2 years, is likely to be in a minor surplus that is decreasing with time. While innovations are significantly occurring within the battery side of things that increase lithium utilization and efficiency, they won't be happening fast enough to really quell the increase in demand, which increases the raw material demand. And the interesting thing with lithium is that while we are seeing mines increasingly struggling to find financing, we see that as a combination of the interest rate environment worsening relative to the last couple of years, and because, yeah, the price has collapsed, but there are still wide expectations of a shortage later in the decade, primarily due to the reasons associated with the overtaking of solid-state batteries and the confusion and the regression, almost, in lithium efficiency and kind of utilization of the metal within a battery. And depending on what that does to price, it may kind of ruin the economics of solid state batteries, because natural graphite prices more so will probably go through the floor at that point in time.
So when it comes to solar modules, there's actually two countries that are serious about building a separate supply chain, one being the US, the other is India. Is there a second country that's trying to build a second supply chain for EVs, or is it the US, not for EVs, for batteries in general, or is that only the US for this?
Europe says that it's interested in building a battery supply chain for the electric vehicle industry.
Like solar, but probably unserious like solar as well.
Exactly. With regards to how much effort it's actually putting into it and support it's offering to companies, it's offering support to a fair number of companies now that it's relaxed its rules with regards to disseminating state subsidies. But that's not particularly successful as of right now. And we're seeing that in the kind of further downstream activity. We're seeing it in cell manufacturing, a little bit in cathode material manufacturing, not enough in anode material manufacturing, but that's the same for the US. And we see problems with regards to the raw material extraction and with regards to setting up things like material refineries. So what we see going forwards from there on is that Europe will import all of its raw materials as it continues to, despite targets set out in the Critical Raw Materials Act, which say they want primary production of 15% production within Europe for the key materials. This would be lithium, phosphate, nickel. That just isn't going to happen because Europe is too bureaucratic and too NIMBYist. It doesn't want mining in its backyard. It's trying quite hard with regards to new technologies. So in the Upper Rhine Valley in Germany, Vulcan Energy are looking to set up a direct lithium extraction system, which functions based on purely green energy because it's, I believe, geothermal. And you take the heat from the geothermal to evaporate the brine and such. Whether or not that's economical will be another question entirely, but that's been given significant support so as to be economical in the short term at least. It'll turn into a situation where Europe is in even more of a need to support its industry than the US, and whether or not it does so will be dependent on the general politics within the European Union itself, because Eastern Europe requires a significant amount of, well, it has been receiving investment from China, whereas Western Europe has been receiving investment from the European Union and from state subsidies. So we have two different kind of lobbies here, and Europe is very much at a crossroads of, do we alienate Chinese supply like the US has and protect our own industry, or do we allow significant Chinese influence within our battery supply chains, which is just fundamentally allowing Chinese influence within the automotive supply chains, which is incredibly important to companies like Germany and France, the UK, despite it not being part of the EU. And so that's the main thing that we're looking at the moment of, is Europe going to do that? Because we're not seeing particular sway either way, but if we had to guess, it will probably turn into a situation of at least partial alienation of supply, which will likely result in retaliatory measures from China, as happened with the Inflation Reduction Act with regards to graphite exports and, I believe, germanium and
the
gallium and
recently
rare earths.
In a tough enough spot that it doesn't have much sort of movement room for a new economic confrontation.
Exactly. It's already between a rock and a hard place with regards to Russian, with regards to the recent issues with Russian natural gas. It can't afford to become dependent on another potentially hostile power. But at the same time, it's already partially dependent on a hostile power because many of Europe's economies depend on Chinese money for a significant proportion of revenue. So things like the luxury goods sector is particularly dependent on Chinese money because that's where the money is right now. It used to be the case that Europe and North America were buying all the luxury goods within their economies. Now it isn't because of various economic setbacks and difficulties associated with maintaining their spots as the world's largest and most affluent economies. Wealthy Chinese individuals have taken that mantle and have ingratiated themselves within European supply chains. So the question is, does Europe risk antagonizing its core audience now? Moving on. So Bogdan, turquoise hydrogen costs. First of all, could you just give us a brief rundown on what delineates turquoise hydrogen from other colors in the hydrogen rainbow that's getting increasingly complicated?
Yes, the hydrogen rainbow does get increasingly complicated and larger by the day because plenty of companies come up with novel methods of manufacturing low carbon or relatively low carbon hydrogen. But turquoise hydrogen is essentially produced from natural gas through pyrolysis. So you burn natural gas in the absence of air, and you get hydrogen and solid carbon, also known as carbon black, instead of emitting gaseous CO2. So you can control the emissions differently from blue hydrogen, where we know the efficiencies of the carbon capture technologies vary, and then never 100%. So on paper, better than blue hydrogen, but obviously there's still issues associated with fugitive emissions from natural gas. So those won't be fixed by any manufacturing process, because it's nothing to do with the way you make hydrogen, but the way you acquire the feedstock rather. But regardless, we basically have news that the largest turquoise hydrogen plant commenced construction in Finland, and aims to produce about 2,000 tons of turquoise hydrogen per year once it's operational.
How many tons, pardon?
2,000 tons.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Per year. The company released in the press release, they released the essentially how much money it cost them to build this this plant. Money, by the way, which they got through grants and investors and everything. So not out of their own pocket. But it was 20 million euros for a plant that produces 2,000 tons of hydrogen. So I did a couple of calculations. I accounted for the feedstock, for the price of natural gas as feedstock. They even quote the amount of electricity they need. They say it's only 13% of the electricity required compared to an electrolysis plant. So I did some calculations, and the price comes out to about $9.6 per kilogram, something in that space, which is still pretty outrageous given the context and the climate, and the fact that green hydrogen is aiming to get down to $1.5 per kilogram to be competitive with natural gas. Granted that this is basically one of the first projects in the world, or amongst the first, so we expect the prices to be high at this point.
There is a case to be made that the CapEx for this particular factory in this project is going to be outlandishly high. How flexible is the OpEx with regards to future improvements?
Well, I mean, the big part of the price is the CapEx. So in that sense, it's quite the opposite of green hydrogen, where the OpEx is actually the larger part. So you're really dependent on electricity prices when you're talking about green hydrogen, and then improvements in the cost of electrolyzers won't move the mark too much for green hydrogen. But there's always, when you link yourself to natural gas as a feedstock, there's always the risk of the price of natural gas going up through the roof, like we've seen in the last couple of years. They've been extremely volatile, so relying on such a feedstock is a bit risky.
Also, if you're trying to be competitive with the price of natural gas, surely using natural gas as a feedstock isn't the wisest of moves.
Yeah, essentially. That's a good observation. It's
because of efficiencies, mm-hmm. losses and such with regards to chemical conversions.
Of course, of course. You'll never be able to match the price of natural gas if you use it as a feedstock.
So what's the end game for this company? What's the end game for turquoise in particular, when you're, or even grey hydrogen? Or is it just an interim solution that's partially greenwashing?
I mean, I don't know. We don't see it as an interim solution. It's a speculative attempt. You know, it's a technology that can produce hydrogen. There's obviously a need for hydrogen. Loads of companies try to make it through different ways, quoting the price will go down, but it never will, because not enough people will actually use this this technology. Even if you manage to sell the carbon black, which has a value as a byproduct in products such as tires or some plastics, so there's a secondary market for carbon black there. Even if you do that, you won't be able to recover much, maybe $1 or $2 if you're lucky per kilogram, which would only reduce the price of hydrogen down to maybe $8 per kilogram. So we're still talking miles away from the industry goals when it comes to green hydrogen.
Yeah, those aren't particularly high-value secondary markets when we're talking about selling off additional feedstocks. As you mentioned, tires and such, it's very much whatever the hell's left over from oil production that's used with regards to that sort of manufacturing to keep costs down. All right, well, that's interesting. So we can say pretty soundly that turquoise hydrogen isn't a technology for the future, and that companies purporting it and that seem overvalued probably won't be for very long. Okay, that's good to know. Moving on. Andreas, China's having another grid congestion issue, this time the fault of distributed solar?
Although you say another one, but as far as I'm aware, the last big one was in 2017 or so is when they killed it off. Which was also from their renewables, actually. They built a whole load of utility scale renewables off in the desert. And ever since then, they've been tracking the curbing of that curtailment that resulted, and they've brought it back down to a few percent outside of Tibet, where it's still high. Anyway, the news now is so last year, I'm pretty sure that 400 gigawatts was built of solar around the world. I think that's where the number will come out. And fully 100, I almost wrote 96 gigawatts for this article, but then I found it was actually a nice big round 100, perfect for a headline. 100 gigawatts of that was Chinese, specifically rooftop Chinese. Over 200 gigawatts of China in total. So it's an absurd amount, and a lot of it's quite clustered into the coastal provinces, as well as a couple ones that are a little bit inland, like Anhui province and Hebei province. Sorry, I'm probably mispronouncing all of these, so apologies to any Chinese that are listening. Now, it's kind of reminiscent of when Vietnam suddenly built 14 gigawatts of rooftop solar in 2020 with an absurdly over-generous feed-in scheme. And since then, they've said, well, no new solar ever again, because we've got 10% curtailment and suddenly 20% of our entire nominal capacity is solar, and any new stuff is just ad hoc self-consumption for at least a couple of years. I think they still built a gigawatt last year, but so that's what happens. That's how much you have to build in 1 year to get horrible grid congestion in a nation of 100 million in Vietnam. You need about 14 gigawatts. So 100 gigawatts in China, which is 14 times the population, it's not actually that bad. And this story is about, like, what's the reaction to this? Surely you're going to get grid congestion. Surely that's going to happen. But I'm not actually sure it is happening yet, because what is being announced across China is this province has some grid congestion issues. This municipality has some grid congestion issues. This county has grid congestion issues, and it no longer has any room. And this place with 650,000 citizens that has so far built 14 megawatts of solar says it can't build any more because there's no room on the local transmission grid, and it's like the Netherlands in that regard. Well, there's no overarching figure, annoyingly. So I've tried to find some big examples and put them together to give an impression, but that's all I'm able to do is just give an impression. I think they probably can get away with building another 100 gigawatts or a little bit more this year. But we are starting to see some congestion, might have to move inland. And the other thing that's happening is you're starting to see some co-located battery storage requirements. And this is very much like the utility scale segment in China, where China does have these sort of structures for a liberalized market grid. Like it even has a carbon credit market. It's got two carbon credit markets and it's had them for 10 years. But they're still localized and they're still low price. It's just, we want to be able to run it if we feel like it. But we still feel okay just having a grid pricing system that's based on coal mining, ultimately. And similarly, China is adopting time of day pricing, but it's still quite clunky and sort of traditional and centrally controlled. We're going to divide the day up into three or four predefined periods, and here's the ratio of price. And in this period, it'll be four times the price. So you pass 4 o'clock and the electricity price quadruples or something. Well, that might be a slight exaggeration. But anyway, my point is they probably could do something a lot more similar to the West if they wanted to. They just aren't. And so that means battery storage doesn't have a proper like financial case yet. It's not getting those crucial, really high price periods that it's rewarded with intermittently in the West, like with the Tesla battery that was built in 2017 in Australia and was leading the world. So what instead they did was they said, okay, we're starting to get too much intermittent power on the grid. So every time from now on that anyone builds a solar or a wind farm, you have to put 2-hour duration batteries equal to between 10 and 30% of nominal capacity alongside it. And the variation depends on how much intermittent renewables there are on the grid in this particular province out of 30 provinces. And apparently they're going to do something similar, I think, with distributed solar. But again, it's kind of hard to cover because it's done on a municipal basis, on a provincial basis, on a city basis. So someone is going to have to count through hundreds of municipalities and average them out. And it's not going to be me. So before we get an overarching numerical definition of what exactly is happening. But China did install 20 gigawatts of over 20 gigawatts of battery storage, like 46 gigawatt hours of battery storage last year, which is twice the amount the year before that. So it's definitely on the up and up.
It's interesting to see that, particularly with the co-located battery side of things, there isn't a commercial use case yet, but China is still leading the world when it comes to battery deployments. As you say, it's lacking the market mechanism for profit to be a significant factor in the deployment of these battery assets, but just the forcing of the use of solar, the forcing of the development of it alongside solar deployment, both utility and now residential, as it were, is interesting because, as you say, these carbon markets are ready to be switched on at a moment's notice. They're available for when they properly want to phase out coal as the primary pricing mechanism.
And another big thing that people probably didn't pay enough attention to was China's coal plants have always been paid per megawatt hour of generated electricity. Until, now the details, you might have to go back and read my article from a month ago. I've already started to forget the details. Until this year, and they've changed it, and they've said, from now on, a significant part of the remuneration that you get for building and running a coal plant is simply based on having the capacity available. And that's to reflect the fact that coal, the utilization rate of China's coal fleet is actually going down because the renewable development is so rapid. And that's really remarkable. I mean, last year we had like 400 gigawatts solar, 50 gigawatts of wind built in, 220 gigawatts roughly of solar, 50 gigawatts of wind built last year. That's still, you'd think, not that gigantic compared to all of China. But apparently it was enough to drive down the coal utilization rate, enough that they felt the need to introduce a capacity market, even at the same time as the country increased its electricity consumption by 7% year on year. So, yeah, they are changing, but it's still a controlled sort of state-led thing.
How quickly do you think we'll be able to see China get rid of its coal, kind of the capacity side of it? Because that will be when the carbon markets kind of come into place. I imagine they'll be using the carbon markets to get rid of the coal fleets. So
For now, coal is still totally fundamental to the Chinese grid, and they're still even building some more coal. I think.
Are we talking 10 to 15 years?
Well, if you look at their official targets, they say peak emissions in 2030, net zero in 2060. So they're giving themselves plenty of time. They also said we're going to build 1,200 gigawatts of new renewables by like 2030 or something. And they then did it in 2 years or whatever, 3 years. I remember writing about that a few years ago and saying, well, they're definitely going to do it in 3 years, and then it turned out to be two or something. So probably
that's my point. Yeah, very safe targets.
Yeah,
as you said, the 2016 net zero. I'm not really talking about net zero. I'm more talking about the shifting to a relatively low risk, renewable based energy market, as opposed to coal being the primary determinant. Mm. So because once
what do you mean by low risk though?
Well, once you have a sufficient level of capacity and overcapacity, then the variance is only going to be so high, particularly when you have battery assets mandated to be co-located alongside renewable generation. So the risk is minimized once you have these bits of infrastructure in place, and with China mandating it alongside the renewable generation, it functionally is a matter of time before they can say, we don't need this coal anymore. It's the same with anywhere, but instead of with coal, with natural gas. Once you get rid of the, well, once you have sufficient storage, you don't need the peaking facilities because they do fundamentally the same job.
Hmm. Or rather, you still need the peaking facilities, but you just very, very rarely use them.
Exactly. Yeah exactly. So you can change the pricing to be...
Well, I haven't put a number on it, but we used to say when they introduced the 2030, 2060 targets, we said, oh, it'll be 2028 and 2055. But they've exceeded even our expectations. So maybe it's 2027 and 2050 for
peak. I'm starting to think even earlier than that, considering, well, we're still seeing record kind of deployments when it comes to solar, correct, to be topped out next year.
Yeah, by record, it's like China built the same amount this year that the entire world did, including China, the previous year. So it's like,
Yep. And they doubled the production. And that's only slowing down somewhat, isn't it?
Well, not yet. It's decelerating.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I mean. Yes, decelerating. Apologies.
The solar equivalent is slowing down.
Well, depending on your opinion of China, that may be good news, that may be bad news. But for the world as a whole, that's pretty damn good news. Moving on to some of the short items from this week's issue. Let's have a quick look. An interesting one is that BYD has announced that it will be spending 100 billion yuan, which is about 14 billion USD, on smart car features and things like autonomous driving and such. So, sounds like a lot of money because it is, but when it comes to autonomous driving, that won't go too far, particularly as it's not just entering the autonomous driving space, but it's very new to it relative to everybody else who's been focusing on it because of the potential for robo-taxis and such. But it's interesting to see that BYD is now saying, instead of going, okay, we're going to build a factory here, here, and here to produce extremely low-cost, reasonably high-quality electric vehicles for X market and Y market, it's saying, okay, now we're at a point where we can just say, okay, we're going to spend X amount on autonomous driving features. To me, at least, it says we have our factory deployment under control with regards to what markets we want to enter as a matter of priority. And now it's going to be looking more at producing towards the mid-range of electric vehicles, as opposed to just making the bare bones, the BYD Seals and the Dolphins of the world, which are very good electric vehicles in and of themselves, but they aren't anything groundbreaking. They're low cost, they're simple, they're produced in a cheap climate by a company that knows what it's doing. But now it is expanding towards the kind of Tesla end of vehicle quality, and it'll surpass that, I believe, relatively quickly, at least on a price-to-performance basis.
Well, I've got something that I'd like to mention. They look individually quite uninteresting, but there were just so many solar manufacturing announcements out of China. And normally, sorry to bang on about that topic as I endlessly do, but my estimate has been 500 gigawatts of manufacturing production capacity expansion in China, some of which, to be fair, is replacing slightly obsolete stuff, so the net effect is smaller. But that would involve 10 gigawatts a week, and this is just more than 10 gigawatts in 1 week. Maybe there's like an end of year, start of year thing, peak or something, but it was just enormous, and you can see those listed towards the end of the issue. Yeah. Oh, there's another thing actually on that topic, which is so we've mentioned intermittently the idea that polysilicon could be made outside of China. Shock, you know. And there's been so little built fresh outside of China, and so much of the stuff that already exists outside China has been mothballed or gone bankrupt in really the past year or decade. So we're looking at the possibilities. One is Quinbrook Infrastructure Partners proposing one in Queensland. There's been a couple of proposals in Saudi and the UAE. There's another one now in the Gulf States, and it's only seems to be reported by Chinese media. And the Omani Observer newspaper posted about it and then deleted it. So I'm not sure if it's actually real, but there's a reportedly a $58 million sale of polysilicon production equipment by Shuangliang Group to an Omani company, United Solar Polysilicon. That would be for a 100,000-ton facility, which is like, that's like 40 gigawatts worth these days. And like I said, I'm not sure if it's actually happening, but there seems to also have been a fairly new silicon metal facility built in the same location in the Sohar Free Zone or under construction. And you do want the silicon metal to be close by because it's so worthless that if you transport it, it effectively doubles the cost because it's only worth $2 per kilogram. So I think it's just a possibility, in my opinion.
It's interesting to see more so as an overarching theme that, as you say, there's been interest in solar manufacturing from the from the Gulf states, from the Middle East. And again, that's just very much part of the trend where they're moving away from oil towards renewable energy manufacturing. But would you say that any of these projects are going to be economical when compared to Chinese production? In the long run.
I almost wonder if their real purpose is just to be semi-Chinese, like Chinese expertise, Chinese companies, but not as restricted in terms of trade. That might be it.
My main concern with that is I don't see the incentive that Chinese companies particularly have. Well, so we've seen with the IRA that you can put in provisions into policy that say X amount of Chinese ownership is not allowed for subsidies and will incur tariffs instead. You see it in the IRA's foreign entity of concern rules. So that needs to be done very carefully, and it can update with policy, because if you're fairly blatantly just skirting the lines of the policy, that policy can change to encompass you. So there needs to be a level of safety involved in that, and outside of that, even what is the incentive for Chinese companies to be doing that? Other than licensing fees, it can just sell into these markets at a higher rate as opposed to selling through another company. The way I see it, at least, is it's more that maybe the Gulf states are finally getting their act together. This is a bold statement. And saying that they will be trying to produce their own manufacturing as opposed to importing from China.
It's also a bit
their own development. Oman's been very active, particularly within the green hydrogen space. Bogdan, I remember there being some significant announcements with regards to renewable developments within Oman specifically.
Yes, Oman has been showing a bit of a different attitude compared to the other Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, and countries like that. And they have been promoting wind and solar and hydrogen quite heavily, and they have quite ambitious targets compared to their neighbors.
Whether or not those can actually be met is a different question entirely, but it's a change in tune from the Gulf states in particular, so I wouldn't be surprised if this was real. But at the same time, the newspaper deleting it is a bit of a concern. Anyways, we can leave that one up in the air until we see a shovel hit the ground in a relative area. All right, so and with that, we'd like to end this week's episode of the Rethink Energy podcast. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we have more articles on our website at rethinkresearch.biz. That's .biz. You hit energy, and then you're there under the weekly analysis section. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode, and we'd like to see you again next week. Goodbye for now.